Happy Monday, everyone. Quick update before we begin this episode. These episodes, at least the first four episodes of our podcast, Extra Time by TEDx Kaya Leuven, are pre-recorded in lockdown periods. So if you hear anything that is slightly outdated, don't worry, you're not crazy. Belgium isn't still in lockdown, or isn't for at the moment, at least. And this was all just pre-recorded. My name is Julius. I'm the curator and licensee of TEDx Kaya Leuven, and you're listening to Extra Time. Roll the beat.
Roll the beat.
Hey guys, and welcome to the second episode. Last time we talked about psychiatry, and today we're talking history with Bram de Ridder. Bram is an historian within the Modern Era Research Group at the KUL, and he's the coordinator of consulting platform Corvus, that's Corvus, which is a platform that gives advice to government agencies, among others, based on what we can learn from history. So the team behind Corvus looks to past events similar to today's issues and prevents us from repeating mistakes by our ancestors. Is that a good summary, Bram?
I think so, yeah. We try to do this on a scientific way, so we do a lot of research on these topics. We don't try to give just advice, random advice, but we try to really look into the methodologies as well. If you look to the past, to learn something for the present, how do you do this? Which are your best methods? Which are your best tricks to do so?
Well, I think it's a great initiative, and it must be unique in its kind, as historians do not often enter the public debate or the public foreground.
Well, they do so more and more, especially after Brexit and the United States election of 2016, when Trump was elected. You saw a lot of historians entering the public debate. But we also noticed that this happens in a lot of different ways, and the response is not always the one that we want to see. So that's one of the reasons why we started this project, because we really want to see what are the best ways of doing this. And yes, we are quite unique. There are other historical consultancies out there. There are other research initiatives about applied history. They exist. They're very young, but they exist. But I think that worldwide, we are the only ones who have both the breadth and depth in topics, the amount of funding that we have, the time. We have 4 years of research that we can do on these questions. So I think that in that regard, we are quite unique worldwide. There might be others who are doing something similar, but I think still within that field that we're doing something that is quite unique. Yeah.
Because you are supported as well by the KUL, for example, in your
We are supported by the Flemish Research Council, who have provided the generous funding for this research, and which is really what allows us to focus on the actual question of, if you want to learn from the past, how do you do it? A lot of the other initiatives you see, they immediately have to prove themselves. They immediately have to find clients. They immediately have to come up with something that is relevant or is not relevant. It's much more do or die for them. We got more time. We got more space to think about, is this really what you should and could do with history when you're in a policy-making context?
Okay, so let's talk a bit more about Corvus. It's relatively young. And what is the team behind it doing right now? What are your current activities and projects?
The current activities that we are doing at the moment is we have three research phases, and we are in the first phase, which is really looking at how do organizations use the past. So as mentioned, a lot of not only historians who enter the public debate, but a lot of organizations and people themselves, they use history. Sometimes they use history when they know it. Sometimes they don't know that they're using history, that they don't know that they're relying on the past. We are really trying to map those uses. So we have within the project, we have 11 partners. And we are analyzing how those partners are using the past at the moment. due to the coronavirus, we've expanded that a bit to other organizations as well. So for example, our most recent research was that we looked at three media outlets in Flanders and looked at how that they used between the 1st of January and the 13th of March, when the lockdown in Flanders and Belgium started. How did they use the past in their media coverage? So did they look at SARS in 2002, 2003? Did they look at the plague? Did they look at the Spanish flu? Which were the historical examples they used? And how did they use them? And what were the consequences of that? So for example, we noticed that SARS was really a dominant analogy within the Flemish media, until at one point they noticed, oh, this is already worse than SARS, especially at the moment when the death toll of corona, the new coronavirus, surpassed that of SARS. All of a sudden you saw in the media like, oh, this is not like SARS. We have to find something else to compare it to. So it's not something to blame them for, but you can definitely see that the media and experts as well, experts cited in the media, they made the mistake of thinking, oh, this will be SARS all over again. Don't worry. Whereas it was way too early to make that comparison. We didn't have the data to say this will be the same or this will be different from 2002, 2003. So those kind of things is what we're currently looking at. Who is using the past where, and what are the consequences of using the past if you're doing it for policy purposes?
Okay. And so continuing on the current situation, this might be the first question someone could ask you, knowing about your expertise. Has something like this, the COVID-19 epidemic, ever happened to us in the course of the entire human history before? Has it ever happened before?
That to a large extent, the answer in that question depends on what do you mean by this? What do you mean by the epidemic that you're arguing? Has this happened before or not? In the sense that, of course, epidemics, pandemics, we've had them forever. Writing the history of humankind is writing the history of the diseases that they carry. There are a lot of books that have come out in recent years as well that really look into this question of how has history been influenced by the diseases and the fights against the diseases that we often face. So, no, I mean, for every period, for every era, you have pandemics, you have epidemics that appear. So in that sense, this is not unusual. This is not something that is out of the ordinary from a very long human history perspective. That being said, there is the potential, but I'm a bit hesitant to already say, like, this is unique or this is definitely different than other things that we've seen. There is the global aspect of this, in the sense that new COVID-19 disease spread very rapidly, is currently present all around the globe, not everywhere as severe, because we think that this is, and it is a very severe disease, of course. The death toll is really horrendous, and all of those victims is that's terrible for the families and so on. But if you're looking at Africa, for example, everybody expected it would be much worse there. If you're looking at South America, it could have been worse there. So it's a bit too early to tell how this looks on a global scale. Is it really as devastating all across the world as it is in the United States and Europe at the moment? But definitely the speed with which it spread feels like, and again, we need to be cautious until we have more hindsight. But this feels like the globalization, the global aspect of it is different in degree. You've had global pandemics before, but speed, degree, definitely media coverage, how much attention there is to it, the response to it, that could be something that we've not witnessed before. But the fact that there is a disease, that there is a global pandemic, that we have definitely seen before in history.
So it's comparable, with the exception of globalization, with the exception of being able to travel anywhere at any time, and which probably stimulated the spreading of the disease as well, to an extent.
Yeah, and is it really different? I mean, it is different. Again, I would say it's different to a degree. You had globalization in the Roman period. You've had globalization in the early modern period. You've had globalization in the 19th century, also associated with diseases and the spreading of diseases. So globalization is not something new. The degree to which this globalization has had an effect on the disease, that might be something that is different compared to other diseases. For example, one important thing there is in the important comparison with SARS. What a lot of the commentators missed at first is that China in 2002-2003 was not the China of 2020. I mean, if you look at the number of international flights, the number of international commercial contacts, the number of tourists coming from China, going to China, it's logical that that degree of globalization and interaction with China was not present in 2003, which makes it different. And I'm wondering, it's not a definitive answer, but I'm wondering whether or not that also applies on a global scale. That globalization is in 2020 much deeper, much faster than it has been before in history, which might have had an effect on how the disease spread.
So there is somehow a lack of insight in history and in the media, talking about China and about their history, how it has changed. But what do you think we can learn from our ancestors? So to these comparable situations, how are we doing right now? Are we repeating mistakes or not?
Again, that's a very good and a very interesting question, because it also forces me to a certain extent to have a value judgment on the past, which is something that historians hate to do, because I have to say people in the past were better or worse than we are doing today. That is a very, very tricky question. I would say that the main thing, if you're making that comparison, also look at the different context before you say this is better or worse. For example, let's take the 1918-1919 Spanish flu. That was definitely worse in terms of death toll, even though the death toll today is also quite horrendous, but we're talking about millions at the beginning of the 20th century. Tens of millions of people who died. But the medical expertise was not the same as it is today. So if you would say that people were doing worse in 1918-1919, that's difficult to say, because they did not have the technology, they did not have the means, they did not have the social security systems that we have in place today. So that comparison is very difficult to make. You would have to make a comparison between, were they doing better or worse given the means that were at their disposal? And that's a very difficult exercise to do. And I'm quite hesitant to do it. That being said, you definitely see some human behaviors from earlier pandemics that return. Staying with the example from in 1918-1919, for example, the hesitancy on the part of certain governments to close shops, to close social venues, under pressure from populations who think that it's not that bad, and who think that, why can't I go to the theater? Why can't I go to my local shop? Those were questions that also popped up in the beginning of the 20th century, and certain governments also were fearful of taking drastic measures, even though they knew that they were necessary, but they knew that they were not going be liked for it as politicians. Another thing is that what your authorities say has a huge impact. I mean, during the Spanish flu, Catholic Church in certain places asked people to come together, to gather in mass gatherings to pray, to go to church in order to ward off the disease, which is not something you want to do, but it's an authority that asked you to do it. So you see that a bit with Bolsonaro in Brazil as well, who's also asking, come out, support me. This is not as bad as it seems. There is also the medical aspect, whereby you see certain older practices or superstitions re-emerging. I mean, bloodletting during the Spanish flu re-emerged as well. It's a medieval practice, but given the knowledge of the time, people thought, it can't hurt. This is really bad. We'll try something this old. Other types of, I wouldn't call it magic, but artisanal medicine or medicine that was not supported by science. Whereas today you've had the whole malaria drug saga in the United States, whereby you have the United States president saying, like, this drug will definitely work, whereas it turns out that it's absolutely not something that helps. That's also kind of a bogus medicine that is promoted by certain people, and you've seen that in the past. You're seeing it today. So there are definitely things that can be compared, mostly based on human behavior. But I would be hesitant to say that it's better or worse than it has been in the past. Those contexts are too different to make that value judgment.
Yeah. You said the human history can be summarized in the history of diseases to some extent. Do you think that we're now in a pattern that will be recurring? What do you think we can expect concerning to the future?
Human history, history as the history of human disease, is of course only one possible summary. So there are many other summaries as well, but it is an important aspect. I think in the larger scale, of course, we are in sort of a pattern, in the sense that diseases emerge and reemerge throughout history. There will be a new deadly disease sometime in the future. We don't know when, we don't know how bad it will be, but that pattern will continue, has continued throughout history. In terms of what to expect, I think in the short term, you will see a lot of disruption in certain fields. I mean, think tourism, think airline companies, think the cultural sector. I think the economic fallout will be quite dramatic at the beginning. You will see companies failing. You will see people losing their jobs. You will see the impact of that on a fairly short notice, I think. In the mid to long term, I think I would caution or warn for the more gradual changes, in the sense that this now gives us an idea that the next 10 years, 15 years, everything will need to be focused on diseases, will need to be focused on viruses, on hygiene, on combating or preventing that this will happen ever again. It will happen. And it will divert attention away from other things. We will be missing the next big crisis because we're now focused on this element. I think the best comparison here I can come up with at the moment is what happened after the 9/11 attacks. You had an immediate short-term impact, war in Afghanistan, all sorts of anti-terror measures, but the longer changes from that one seminal event, they're still lasting today. I mean, we're still dealing with the consequences of what happened then. You're still seeing people debating surveillance. You're still people talking about radicalism. Those changes were not necessarily readily apparent in the months and even the first 2 years or 3 years after 9/11. It's only now that we're seeing the bigger impact. I think that coronavirus it might be something similar, that we see a lot of short-term changes that we can grasp and that we can deal with, and that only in 5, 10, 15 years we'll be looking back and saying, oh, that is where things have changed. That is where the real difference was made.
Is it that it's because we're missing the bigger picture? Because we're, like you said, we're handling on the short term, but we're not tackling the underlying causes, which is the relation between human and nature, humankind and nature.
For example, I don't know enough about this. It's not my field of expertise, but I'm a bit hesitant to look too much to the relation between humans and nature. That relationship has been under strain also for a very long time, longer than we think. There is a connection there, but I would need to look more into it, deeper into it, before I can really say, okay, this is relevant in this way. I think I'm looking more at the societal, the social consequences and causes. For example, will we be refunding our public health institutions? Will the government take a role in there, or will that be further privatization? We're now applauding for all the nurses and medical staff here in Flanders and everywhere in the world. Will we be actually hiring more of them? Will we actually pay them more? Will we give them more practical support? Or is that something that we will not do? I'm also looking at the apps that people are debating to trace your context. I mean, the ease with that was introduced still surprises me a bit. I mean, again, I don't know enough about the technology itself, but just the idea that you have to install, or you're pushed towards installing an app that traces who you meet, that is something that we need to be very careful in considering. And I think a bit that because we're dealing with the short term, which is logical, by the way, we won't be thinking in those sort of strategic terms. So it might be in 10, 15 years that all of us have such an app on our phone and that it's not a problem and that we think that's fine. We wouldn't have had that app without Corona. And I'm not sure that it's entirely without risk to have done so. Again, a bit like 9/11, all of a sort, internet surveillance is all over the place or is very much present. There are certain anti-terror measures that are quite far-reaching into your private sphere. We wouldn't have had them without the prior crisis, and they're now here to stay. I think we will see something similar with Corona.
Okay. So talking about the effects of crises, obviously the effects can be, to a certain extent, I think, divided in demographic segments, like for this part of the population, what is the impact, etc. So to the demographic subset that I'm interested in, obviously the next generation, youngsters, students, what do you think the lives will be like? What do you think that will be, looking across history, what do you think the results will be for us concerning employment, concerning quality of life, etc.?
That really depends on which other factors also interfere with this crisis. What you're asking is a really concrete prediction, like how will this impact me? I cannot provide you with that answer, and anyone who claims that they can provide you with that answer is lying. You can't predict the future. You can make an estimated guess, but you can't predict it. So any certainty, because in a sense what you're asking is a question about certainty, what will my life look like in the future?
Well, not certainty, more educated guesses, that's what we're going for, because of course it's not a certainty.
Well, you're right, but it's important to make that difference, because an educated guess quickly becomes a prediction, especially once it's picked up in broader media. For me, I think, employment will be tough the next few years. That will be for everyone, and especially if you're entering the job market, I think it will be tough. But again, it really depends on the measures that we're taking now, and the effects of which we will see in the longer run. For example, the stimuli packages that several governments are now issuing, it might be that they're very successful and that this is a very, not a mild dip, but a very short-term dip in economic effect. It might be that it lasts longer and that this will be a tough economic decade. I mean, I'm not an economist, so I can't, even there, I can't make an educated guess. But from my perspective, let me answer it in this way. If you look at history, I'll go back to history, which is better for me as this is my expertise. If you look at history, humans are very good at adapting themselves. So this might be a tough period. We don't know what is coming. But most humans have proven themselves throughout history very capable of adapting themselves to different circumstances, good circumstances and bad circumstances. So my answer would be that, yes, it'll be difficult. We don't know what is coming. Nobody can tell us. But I think we have the capacity to adapt ourselves. I think we might not be able to do the same or everything exactly the same as before, but we'll adapt and we'll move on. I think that'll be the best conclusion I can offer in that respect.
That's a good positive view, which sounds reasonable. So we had a fun fact question that some of our listeners had about an outbreak of a lab-created virus and if that ever occurred in history. So my question to you, Bram, did this ever occur in history?
Well, that really was a fun fact question because I had to look it up. I'm not a medical historian. I focus on the history of borders in my previous research, and currently I focus, as mentioned, on applied history. So I'm not really the one who knows this by heart. So I had to do some research of my own. And my initial thought was, no, this won't have happened before. I've never heard of something like this. This is a Hollywood scenario. And then I found very quickly, some research paper by Martin Furmansky of the Center for Arms Control and Non-Proliferation, which is a nonprofit in the United States. And in his report, he actually lists several cases of viruses escaping from a laboratory. So for example, this paper mentions outbreaks of the smallpox in the United Kingdom in the 1960s and the 1970s, which goes back to research on smallpox in the United Kingdom, or hospitals who had strains of the virus in store, just mainly for purposes being able to compare potential diseases people with potential smallpox to an actual sample. Those diseases got out and in certain cases infected and killed people outside of their containment environments. So that UK example was already a surprise to me. The paper also mentions, for example, that the H1N1 virus, which is the virus responsible for the Spanish flu in a different form, however, that was also a virus that escaped in the 1970s. From research facilities in Russia, in Eastern Russia and China. The interesting thing there is, especially if you compare it to the stories we have today, is that it's actually still not certain that was related to a laboratory outbreak, but it's difficult to find another explanation. So if you read the paper by Furmansky, you mentioned that scientists have found it difficult to come up with other natural explanations for the specific type of virus that then circulated. But that it seems that just not to embarrass the Russians and the Chinese in that period, that many people played down the option of this being an SKP virus, which it very well might have been. And then also surprising to me, the 2002-2003 SARS virus, which is the one that we most commonly compare to the new coronavirus, that has actually escaped 6 times already in that brief time that it was around. It escaped in Singapore, in Taiwan, and 4 times in China, according to the research paper. Apparently, SARS is very difficult to contain. It spreads fairly easily. So they have clearly had troubles containing this specific virus. Surprise! I thought this was a Hollywood type question, but there is real basis for it. But as the H1N1 case demonstrates, I don't think we will ever know for this virus whether or not it was the wet market in Wuhan or the research facility there that is really responsible for the outbreak. I think the interest for the United States is to link it to the research facility. The interest for China is not to link it to the research facility, and every other country in between will have to come up with some sort of version of their own, whether or not they believe the US version or the Chinese version. But knowing for sure, I think maybe in 30, 40 years, if we're lucky.
Well, it was surprising to me too. And like you said, it's more a Hollywood associated scenario. And it's not to feed into any conclusions about this virus, but it's certainly shocking that it happened before, and 6 times with the SARS virus, for example.
Yeah. So the interesting thing is what history teaches for me to a large extent is to keep your options open. History shows that I wouldn't say anything can happen, but a lot of the things that you think are not possible have been proven by history to be possible. And for me, this is one excellent example of that. You think it's not possible that a virus escapes from a laboratory. We've not seen that in the past. There are no precedents for this if it would be the case. Whereas actually there is a not a fairly long list, but there are cases in which it happened, which clearly demonstrates that both the wet market version have precedence and the escape from a research laboratory version have precedence. So history, again, there teaches to keep both options open at the moment.
So history will surprise us and has surprised us before. Interesting fun fact. Maybe to conclude on a more personal question, if you would like to answer or not, let's say by tomorrow everything is allowed again. What's the first thing you want to do again?
Well, I think there are two things. The first, of course, is to introduce my newborn daughter to a lot of family members and a lot of friends whom she can't meet at the moment. She's 10 days old and she hasn't seen too many people beyond her parents. So I think that is what both my wife and I are looking forward to introduce her to the world, a world beyond lockdown, so to speak. The other thing is that personally, we bought also a house with a good garden, and I would really like to have a garden party at some point in the summer. So I really hope that we can do that, maybe together, invite a few people to meet the daughter and to enjoy the garden that we can't enjoy at the moment, because I'm at an apartment where we don't have the garden available yet. But once we have the garden available to us, I hope that we can invite friends and family as soon as possible to our house and to enjoy sun and nature a bit.
A garden party and a baby shower. Sounds like a plan.
Exactly, yeah.
So thank you very much, Bram, for joining us today. And thank you.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. See you guys. Time to plug this podcast. Let me tell you something, guys. Once you've subscribed to a show, a podcast show, and I just found out about this, the episodes get downloaded automatically, at least on Apple Podcasts, which means that you can from then on, without internet connection, listen to any program you want when you subscribe to it. So if you enjoy this, go ahead and do it, and I promise you won't be let down. See you next week.